That does it for our broadcast. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is hiring a director of development to lead our fundraising efforts. Find out more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Caron, Steve Martinez. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Week on Religion for Life, we talk politics and religion with Joseph Baker.
Religion essentially became a political tool, something that politicians used in order to try to garner votes.
Joseph Baker is a sociologist at East Tennessee State University and author of American Secularism. Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
That's me in the spot.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, black student assaulted at Lewis and Clark after a week of threats and racial slurs.
An anti-KKK rally held in southeast Portland yesterday.
The Pfizer Drug Corporation announces a merger that will make it the largest pharmaceutical in the world.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 23rd, 2015. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Callie Mikhail. A black male student at the Lewis and Clark College was assaulted on Friday night by three white males shouting racial slurs. The attack came just 2 days after Lewis and Clark students held a walkout and protest after racial slurs were used on a popular campus social media site. The racial slurs were posted on the campus Yik Yak social platform just days after the college held the 12th annual Ray Warren Symposium on Race and Ethnic Studies. Ray Warren was a baseball star at Lewis and Clark in the 1960s and returned in 1987 to serve as Associate Dean of Admissions, Associate Dean of Students, and Director of Ethnic Student Services. This is the third year in a row that Lewis and Clark has had racist graffiti or racial slurs spread around the campus following the Ray Warren Symposium on Race and Ethnic Studies. The Portland police claimed that the online threats weren't specific enough to rise to the level of a hate crime. The attack on Friday night is now under investigation by the Police Bureau's Bias Crimes Unit, who are saying it's too early to know if the racial slurs and the assault are related. In just released news out of Lewis and Clark College, university officials are now admitting that there was a second assault on campus on Saturday, this one against a transgender student. No further information is known about that attack at this time.
A lawsuit was filed today in federal court against the city of Berkeley, California, and its police department over acts of police brutality committed against Black Lives Matter protesters almost a year ago. The plaintiffs are 11 people who were clubbed, tear-gassed, slammed to the ground, shot with so-called less-than-lethal impact weapons, or groundlessly arrested by police during a demonstration last December. The plaintiffs include a photographer for the San Francisco Chronicle and a minister. They're being represented by civil rights attorneys from the National Lawyers Guild. KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Rachel Lederman, co-counsel on the case and president of the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, to find out more.
Yeah. During that time period, this demonstration took place right after the grand jury decision in New York not to indict the officer who was responsible for the choking death of Eric Garner, and was part of the wave of Black Lives Matter protests across the United States in late 2014, responding to rampant killings of black people by white police officers with no accountability. So there were demonstrations all over the Bay Area in that time period, and the National Lawyers Guild sends legal observers and provides volunteer legal support for most demonstrations in the Bay Area and nationally. And we've done a lot of work around trying to put some checks on police use of force and unlawful arrests of demonstrators in San Francisco and Oakland. But to our surprise, in late 2014, the main city that we where we observed a lot of unlawful behavior by the police and where we got a lot of complaints was Berkeley.
11 people clubbed, tear gassed, slammed to the ground. What can I say? I note in particular one of them was a San Francisco Chronicle photographer.
There's a couple of plaintiffs in the case who are photojournalists who are visibly photographing or videotaping the demonstration. When they were targeted, Sam Wilson is a photographer who was on assignment from the San Francisco Chronicle and was kneeling down taking a photograph with his professional camera, pretty obvious as a journalist, when he was actually hit on the head with a police baton by a Berkeley officer for really no reason at all. And another plaintiff in the case, Rashid Shabazz, is a professional journalist who was videotaping the demonstration when Berkeley police officers started hitting his camera, apparently trying to break his camera, and also hitting him in the course of that, and then struck him again on the knee. Another one of the plaintiffs who is not a professional journalist but was videotaping the demonstration also had Berkeley police officers target his camera, hitting at his camera and also hitting him. So this is pretty outrageous, and that's what led to our deciding to file this litigation, as well as the indiscriminate use of force against the demonstrators and even some people who were just trying to get home.
I note that there's been a recently data released showing that Berkeley police are engaging in stop and search activity, showing apparent racial bias. Could you tell me more about that?
Yeah, Berkeley's stop data is pretty shocking for a stark pattern of disparity indicating racial profiling of Blacks and Latinos in Berkeley, who are very disproportionately stopped in relation to their percent of the population. And what's more, not only do they get stopped more, but the data shows that they're being stopped for no reason because their stops are not leading to tickets or arrests, whereas when white people get stopped, you can see that usually they are then getting a ticket. Because showing that there was a basis for the stop. So, you know, so this is another thing that we're very, you know, concerned about with the Berkeley police. There seems to be an attitude that Berkeley is such an enlightened place that they can do no wrong, when in fact some of their statistics and actions are among the most egregious in the Bay Area. And that was what was true for this demonstration and why we had to file this case.
Once again, I've been speaking with Rachel Lederman, co-counsel to the plaintiffs in the case Johnson v. City of Berkeley, president of the National Lawyers Guild San Francisco Bay Area Chapter. More about them at nlgsf.org. Ms. Lederman, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
On Wednesday, Chicago police will release the video of a white officer shooting a black teenager 16 times. The city is bracing for possible unrest. The police say that 17-year-old Laquan McDonald had a knife. His shooting took place after a call concerning vehicle break-ins at a trucking yard. McDonald was shot 16 times in the back, even when he was on the ground and not moving. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel issued a statement criticizing the police, saying that this officer violated trust at every level. The officer responsible for the shooting, Jason Van Dyke, is still at his desk job while the investigation continues. Even though the family has not sued, in April the city of Chicago has offered the McDonald family $5 million.
Sarah, you helped organize...
Residents of Southeast Portland held a rally this Sunday to say no to the Ku Klux Klan and racism. This comes after a series of recruitment flyers for the KKK appeared in the Portland area. Identical flyers were placed on hundreds of cars and driveways in Molalla, Gresham, and Oregon City over the past 2 weeks.
The flyers were filled with contradictions and errors and claimed to represent the white supremacist group known as the Ku Klux Klan. Following the rally in the Lentz neighborhood, participants joined in a solidarity vigil, marking the one-year anniversary of the murder of 12-year-old Tamir Rice in Ohio. Tamir was killed by two officers who shot the boy within seconds of getting out of their vehicle when they allegedly mistook the child's toy gun for a real gun. The officers involved in that killing, both white, were recently found by a judge to have acted reasonably in their killing of the 12-year-old child. For more on the rally against hate in East Portland yesterday, I spoke with Sarah Rudolph, one of the organizers of the event. Sarah, you helped organize a public rally for racial justice yesterday at Lentz Farmers Market. What was the reason for the rally?
Well, it was actually kind of multi-purpose. There have been a number of KKK activity scares going on in the last couple of weeks. I'm sure you've heard about people getting KKK notes and jelly beans in their mailboxes in Gresham and West Lynn and Oregon City. Although we certainly don't see the KKK out in the streets parading, we certainly do need to be vigilant of white nationalist organizations of that sort, because they thrive on fear and intimidation. And so to ignore them and just try to sweep it under the rug, we don't feel is the right response. And then in addition, there's so much else going on right now that seems to provoke white backlash in our communities. We've got, you know, the discussion on Syrian refugees and threats to Muslim people.
Oh, even the attack
on the Lewis and Clark campus.
I was just going to mention that, yes.
Yeah, with the online threats, which then seems to have materialized into an actual attack. So we're definitely interested in promoting safe communities and giving people options other than white nationalist hate groups to come together.
Do you know if police have investigated the passing out of the KKK flyers and the candy in those neighborhoods, Gresham and Lentz area?
It seems the official statement from at least Gresham was that they declined to investigate, that they did not think it was an important thing or a big deal, and that they would just ignore it, which is actually one of the things that prompted our rally, because we definitely feel like people already have a little bit of mistrust when it comes to the police and these types of organizations, because of course there is some crossover in the membership there. And so when, you know, we had the whole incident with Mark Kruger, who was basically fired and then reinstated for posting Nazi memorabilia in a public space, and he's been reinstated and is still working for the Portland Police Department. So it makes it a little difficult to trust that when you call, somebody will actually pay attention to the threat that you're reporting.
With the apparent lack of police involvement here, what are people of color in those neighborhoods doing to protect themselves?
Well, you know, I can't speak to that, but one of the things that we wanted to do was we're working on putting together a safe ride program, where if people in those neighborhoods, Muslim people, Black people, people of color, trans, LGBTQ people, if they're feeling threatened, we hope to soon offer them a network to find safe rides and accompaniment. So I think that's something that we can do. And I also, one of the things that we do, because the group that I'm with, Forward, which is for white accountability and racial dialogue, we promote talking to other white people. If you've got a racist cousin who might be prone to joining a group like that, we encourage you to talk to them first.
What would you suggest? I'm sure a lot of conversations like that might be going on over the Thanksgiving meal this coming Thursday.
Oh, definitely. Well, and you know, we try to come to it from a place, I find that it's very effective to start by asking questions, ask people why they think the things that they do and what has led them to these stances. And sometimes just by asking those questions and examining the answers together, you can kind of come to a common ground about what makes sense and what doesn't. So a lot of the time, if you ask some questions, find out kind of where they're coming from, and then maybe relate a personal story about a woman that you work with who happens to be Muslim, who, you know, is just like everybody else. That kind of thing can really get to people. We do a lot of that sort of thing, but we also feel like offering support structures for people who might be vulnerable to joining that kind of organization is something that we need to look into, just in general across the country.
Sarah, for people to get more information on this, where can they go?
Well, we have a Facebook group page, and it's forward, capital F, lowercase O-R, capital W-A-R-D, for white accountability and racial justice.
We've been talking with Sarah Rudolph, a co-founder of the organization Forward, about yesterday's Rally for Racial Justice at the Lentz Farmers Market. This is Ken Jones with KBOO News.
With the drop in temperatures over the weekend in the Portland area and more cold weather on the way, houseless people are facing conditions that may prove deadly. In the past year, according to the Multnomah County Medical Examiner, more than 50 houseless people died on the streets of Portland. Despite the mayor's recent declaration that $30 million will be devoted to addressing homelessness and the lack of affordable housing, no new shelters for men will be opening this winter. There will, however, be a new shelter opening in 3 days for women. The shelter will be at the Old Armory Building in Southwest Portland and will provide shelter for close to 200 women and couples. But it will only be open for the next 6 months. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with George Devendorf, the executive director of Transition Projects, about the new temporary shelter and about the warming centers that will be open on extremely cold nights this winter.
George, could you start by telling our listeners about the warming centers that are being opened up as the cold weather is moving in?
Absolutely. So this past Saturday night, we got word from the city that the temperatures were going to be dropping into what we consider to be a dangerous range. That is an actual or wind chill temperature of about 25 degrees or less. And so we opened up quite quickly two different centers, one downtown and one across in the inner east side, to enable what turned out to be 100 folks to come in from outside of that cold. And we're anticipating doing that probably several more times this week. The forecast seems to be lining up that way for the next couple of nights.
And what if the temperature is above that, but it's raining? Is there any leeway as far as opening the warming center?
There is. There's kind of a algorithm of sorts associated with both precipitation and snow and accumulation of snow. So that's what the city uses in order to determine whether or not the shelters, the emergency severe weather shelter, should be opened on a given night.
And where is the emergency severe weather shelter?
So there's two that we operate, and then there are others, generally smaller, available in other areas around the community. Ours are at the Bud Clark Commons in Old Town next to the train station and bus station. And the other is in partnership with the Imago Dei community at their center, which is just over at 12th Avenue in Ankeny. Well, the one shelter that the city is currently investing in, new shelter, will be opened. We will open it on Thanksgiving Day out in Multnomah Village, and that's at the Jerome Sears Army Reserve facility. That shelter will run through the winter, starting Thanksgiving and ending sometime in May. That's for 6 months only. So our challenge as Transition Projects, but also as a community, is to make sure between now and then we're identifying other locations where longer-term, year-round shelter space can be established. So this is a center primarily devoted towards women experiencing homelessness. So once it's operating at full capacity, we'll be able to accommodate as many as 175 individuals. So first preference will go to women. As space allows, we'll invite women who are in couples to utilize the space as well. So we'll have a better sense of that probably after we've been up and running for a week or so, but primarily for women.
So there isn't an emergency shelter other than for the or a new emergency shelter other than the warming shelters for men who are in homelessness.
Right. So far, our community has not yet identified additional space, with one exception, a relatively small facility geared towards veterans, male veterans, to help them get through the winter. But beyond that, there are no additional shelters coming online that would serve men through this winter.
How long are the waiting lists generally?
They're longer than they've ever been. So if you're a man and you apply to get into one of the shelters that we operate, you're going to wait about 5 months. And if you're a woman, you may wait as long as 7 months. So again, it would be spring before you would be able to get into one of those shelters. And that, of course, is with the caveat of what I just mentioned, that with the Sears shelter opening up for this winter, we'll have up to 175 additional spaces for women. So that should help relieve that backlog a bit.
That website, if people are interested in looking for more information, is tprojects.org. The letter T, projects.org. That's Transition Projects. And we've been speaking with the executive director, George Devendorf. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Labor Radio at 6. Joe Clement of Portland Renters United and Chloe Udali discuss Portland's housing crisis and solutions. In the second half of the show, host Jamie Partridge speaks with Michael Heyer of the steelworkers who are locked out and on the picket line in Albany. That's followed by Prison Pipeline at 6:30. Host Emma Lugo interviews Mindy Griffiths from Voice of the Cannabis War. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, rain, low around 40. Tomorrow, showers likely, mainly before 10 a.m. Mostly cloudy, with a high near 45. Today in history, in 1971, the People's Republic of China took its seat at the United Nations. And 1 year ago today, 12-year-old Tamir Rice died after having been shot in a playground by Cleveland police the day before. The quote of the day is from Bell Hooks, who said, "We have to go back to Dr. King's Where Do We Go From Here?" A lot of people, he said, would rather see an end to democracy than have racial equality. We're living that reality, a state-supported white supremacy.
It's 5:21. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Question of the day. How many honeybees are in a beehive? Answer, 55,000. But who's counting? Matt Willey, for one, a highly regarded mural artist, he's been commissioned during the past couple of decades to grace the walls of homes and businesses. And now he's asking you and me to commission 20 new murals by him in various cities, with each wall-size painting being different versions of a common theme, the good of the hive. In particular, these murals will include a total of 50,000 hand-painted honeybees. Willie was motivated by a brief encounter with a single honeybee a few years ago. The tiny creature was crawling slowly across his rug. She was dying, he says, and for some reason I hung out with her until she died. This wholly unexpected spiritual connection with a bee prompted him to do a bit of research, finding that when a honeybee realizes it's sick and could infect the hive, it immediately departs, flying away to die and to protect the health of the interconnected bee family. Bees don't just live in a hive, they are an integral, functioning part of it. The pulsing hive itself is alive, an organic body nurtured by and, in turn, nurturing every bee in the community. It dawned on Matt that this natural truth applies to our human communities as well. When we connect, we thrive, he realized, leading him to launch the Good of the Hive mural project. Using art, social media, film, music, and discussions, he and a happy band of travelers will swarm into communities for several weeks each to, one, raise awareness about the unique importance as well as some special problems of bees, and two, connect people to our human hive and the essential need to work for the good of all. This is Jim Hightower saying, to connect with Matt, the project, honeybees, and the idea of our shared community, go to thegoodofthehive.com.
The University of Washington released a study today that shows negative environmental impact on the Columbia River Gorge by freight trains and coal trains. The data shows that the coal trains are twice as polluting as the freight trains. For more information, KBOO's Rosalind Scott spoke with Michael Lang, conservation director at the Friends of Columbia Gorge.
Can you tell us about this new study from the University of Washington and how it's going to affect our Columbia River Gorge?
Sure. As many people know, coal is transported currently through the Columbia River Gorge. 3 trains per day, up to 5 trains per day even, travel through the gorge in hauling coal in open-topped coal cars. So we've long had an interest and heard reports about coal spewing across the landscape in the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area. This drew the attention of scientists at the University of Washington, who sought to actually document how much coal was coming off of coal trains. And the results are out. They were released today. And they show that coal trains emit double the amount of pollution as normal freight trains. That every coal train pollutes the gorge and landscapes along the Burlington Northern Tracks with coal dust. They recorded several what they term as superduster trains, where very large visible amounts of coal are billowing off of these coal trains, getting into the Columbia River, into wetlands, on private and public lands throughout the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area.
And why aren't these trains covered? Why aren't the loads of coal covered?
That's the most often asked question. And, you know, I think the railroads really have to answer that. They should be covered. First of all, we should be transitioning off of coal to start with. But as they continue to haul this coal by rail, logically, they would be covered. The claims of the railroad are like this, that it's, first of all, economically, it's not feasible. Secondly, that it would cause a spontaneous combustion problems covering the coal. This Powder River Basin coal from Wyoming is particularly susceptible to spontaneous combustion. So their claim is that it can't be covered. However, we know elsewhere in where coal is transported by rail in other countries, they are covering coal cars. So we think it's simply because the coal companies don't want, and railroad companies don't want to spend money on it. Coal would leak off of coal cars regardless of whether they're covered or not. There are cracks and leaks in these coal hoppers that lead to leaks not just out of the top, but also from the sides and the bottom as well. So it's not safe regardless of whether they're covered or not.
Is there a safe way to transport this coal?
You know, there are a number of health risks from the mining of coal to the transportation of coal through our communities and places like the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area, all the way to the coal plants, whether domestically or in Asia. The emissions from these coal plants pollute our atmosphere and cause human health problems. And then, of course, and it's obvious, it's well documented now that coal and burning coal is one of the leading human contributors to global climate change. And that has very severe health implications for communities throughout the globe.
Does the Columbia River Gorge have any sort of special protection against the coal trains?
There is protection for the Columbia River Gorge, first through the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act. More specifically, the Columbia River Gorge is protected as a federal national scenic area. And the National Scenic Area Act, passed in 1986, requires the protection and enhancement of scenic, natural, cultural, and recreation resources in the National Scenic Area. And that authority extends to the operation, maintenance, and expansion of railways within the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area. So there are specifically two laws that this coal pollution is violating. One is the Clean Water Act, and the other is the National Scenic Area Act.
And what are your next steps?
For Friends of the Columbia Gorge, our next step is, first of all, to make sure that this information is provided not just generally to the public, but also to regulatory agencies that are currently reviewing coal export terminals proposed in the Northwest. In particular, there is a proposal in Longview, Washington, on the Columbia River, for a huge coal export terminal. Between 44 and 60 million tons of coal per year would be shipped by rail through the Columbia River Gorge and stored along the Columbia River and then transferred to ocean-going freighters and shipped to Asia. State and federal agencies are reviewing this proposal and its environmental impacts. We believe that this study needs to be included in the review of those coal export terminals, an analysis of how transport of coal is harming places like the Columbia River Gorge and communities all along the rail line. Next, for the pending litigation in federal court, we would and certainly look forward to introducing this study as the latest evidence in a mounting body of evidence that shows that the railroads are polluting our waterways particularly the Columbia River Gorge, with coal dust. They need to stop it, and they also need to clean up the coal that they've scattered all along the railway along the river through the Columbia River Gorge.
We've been speaking with Michael Lang, Conservation Director at Friends of the Columbia Gorge. This is Rosalind Scott for KBOO News.
1 week before the Paris Climate Change Summit, a broad coalition of organizations today urged Interior Secretary Sally Jewell to reject several federal coal mining proposals. The groups called on the Interior Secretary to help prevent the export of U.S. coal and carbon pollution and reinforce U.S. leadership in the global climate change negotiations. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Jeremy Nichols with Wild Earth Guardians, which is one of the groups that issued the letter.
Could you tell us a little bit about what you're requesting?
Yeah, well, right now what we're trying to advance here is a request that the Interior Department say no to 350 million tons of new coal mining in the western United States. Right now they are reviewing five proposals to expand coal mines in the states of Utah, Colorado, Wyoming, Montana, and North Dakota. A very expansive suite of coal mine expansions here that all told stands to unleash more than 650 million metric tons of carbon dioxide. And, you know, all indications are that these mine expansions, these approvals are not even necessary. Worse, it appears that they may be propping up coal companies that are going bankrupt or that may soon be filing for bankruptcy. And so our ask is that the Interior Department start to move to keep our coal in the ground. You know, a lot of people don't understand that the Interior Department is actually the one responsible for 40% of our nation's coal production and a little more than 40% of our nation's carbon emissions associated with coal-fired power plants. They are a root contributor to global warming in the United States, and as such, we are basically urging them to show some leadership here, to finally step up and say no to the coal companies and to tell the American public that they are on board with a plan to keep fossil fuels in the ground and to keep carbon emissions from being released in the first place.
I was surprised to see that 40% of the U.S. annual coal production is from publicly owned coal. Does that mean that that's coal mining on public lands?
Yeah, exactly. It's coal mining on public lands, but more importantly, the coal that is mined that is publicly owned. I mean, it is owned by every American. It's not private coal. It's not state coal. It's coal that everybody from coast to coast has a stake and a say in. And so that's why the leadership here that we're asking for, I think, is even more important. We're not asking. I mean, this is the Obama administration. This is the administration that is expressing a very sincere commitment to meeting the challenge of combating climate change, and an administration that has recognized it's important to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And we want them to put their money where their mouth is, and not only to meaningfully reduce carbon emissions, but to show the world that we are so serious that we're going to start keeping coal in the ground.
These proposals for new coal mines that you mentioned, I think some at least are connected to the proposals for coal export terminals here in the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, most definitely they're connected. One of the mines that would be expanded is the Spring Creek mine in southeast Montana, which already exports some coal through the West Shore Terminal near Vancouver. This is the company that owns the mine is Cloud Peak Energy, and they have been working to advance additional coal port proposals in the Northwest. This latest mine expansion seems very calculated to, position themselves to continue to make money off exports and to push more export capacity in the Northwest. It's interesting, though, another mine that would be expanded in Utah, the company that owns that has actually been pushing for port capacity in Oakland, California, of all places. They actually want to ship more coal through the Bay Area. They amazingly already shipped some coal through the Bay Area, but they want to up that amount by a few million tons a year.
Is that coal transported from Utah by train to Oakland?
It is. It is. Yeah, it's transported by a rail loadout facility that's in central Utah and gets hauled to the Bay Area. So very similar to the Northwest and the train lines there that haul the coal currently and that are going to be hauling the coal in the future if these companies get their export plans locked in.
Well, thanks very much. Again, I've been speaking with Jeremy Nichols. He's with Wild Earth Guardians, and that group, along with Climate Solutions, Friends of the Earth, several other groups, have issued a letter to the U.S. Interior Department calling on the department to stop the proposals for more coal mines that together would unleash more than 650 million metric tons of carbon dioxide, which is as much as is released annually by more than 136 million cars. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
In Myanmar, early on Saturday, a 60-meter-high mountain of earth and waste collapsed, killing 113 jade miners. More than 100 more men are still missing as the landslide buried over 70 makeshift huts where the miners slept. Today, bodies are still being pulled out from the rubble and debris. The jade mines of northern Myanmar produce some of the world's highest quality jade, generating an estimated $31 billion last year alone. The industry's wealth, however, does not reach the locals, but goes to individuals and companies affiliated with Myanmar's former military rulers. The locals of Pakant live in a wasteland of torn land, dirt roads, electricity blackouts, and high heroin addiction rates. Every year, dozens of small-scale miners suffer severe injuries and are killed picking through waste dumps while large companies profit. This accident is the worst such disaster the state has seen in recent memory.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The vote was close, but UAW workers at Ford approved the tentative four-year labor contract. The UAW says 51.4% of production workers approved it. The skilled trades vote was 52.4% yes. The GM contract has also been ratified. UAW President Dennis Williams says our UAW members have ratified the national agreement after a long process and much debate. The voice of the majority has secured a strong future, he says, that will provide job security and economic stability for themselves and their families. Thousands of Chicago teachers are expected Monday for a labor solidarity rally in Grant Park. CTU President Karen Lewis will lead the rally. The union is gearing up for a strike vote. Supporters of the teachers, including clergy, parents, elected officials, and students, will join the rally. Hip-hop group Rebel Diaz will perform, and there will be free food and hot beverages for rally participants. Chicago teachers are facing the threat of 5,000 layoffs and are struggling against school closings and budget cuts as they try to negotiate a new labor contract. The teachers also object to a school board that's appointed rather than elected by the communities the schools serve. The Chicago Teachers Rally starts at 4:30 p.m. in Grant Park on Monday. McDonald's is under scrutiny in Europe for allegedly dodging more than €1 billion in taxes since 2009. At a European Parliament hearing, McDonald's was questioned about the taxes. One member of Parliament said McDonald's is a free rider right now, and the company is not allowed to be a free rider in the European tax system.
This is Mitch Lawrence with the Sports Minute for Workers Independent News. Here in New York, the teeming holiday crowds have started to descend on Times Square at all hours of the day and night. When you walk through most days now, it's an armed camp with counterterrorism units patrolling with semi-automatic weapons. That's because Times Square is one of several places that are called quote-unquote soft targets in the world of terrorism. And obviously, New York is on high alert after the recent attacks in Paris. You know what brought the attacks a little closer to our world? The fact that there are many players in the National Basketball Association who are either French or have ties to France. Those include the Knicks' Kevin Serafin, who hails from French Guiana and who spent his teenage years in Paris. He played professionally there before coming to the United States, and his parents still live in the French capital. Serafin was badly shaken by the attacks and wanted to do something dramatic to show everyone that he was thinking of his countrymen back home. So he had his barber shave the word Paris into the back of his head. The A looks like the Eiffel Tower. A Serafin told me the other day, quote, "We can't be scared of the terror. We have to fight through it," unquote. Well, he and the other players who have loved ones back in Paris are doing their best to play these days. They're doing it with heavy hearts. Whether you root for their teams or not, they should be cheered.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
A new report from the United Nations has found that so-called biodegradable plastics will not solve the problem of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. The biodegradable plastics that have been created in recent years require very specific conditions in order to biodegrade. And these conditions simply do not exist in the ocean, where most of these plastics end up. Instead, they end up contributing to the large islands of plastic, like the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which are springing up in every ocean in the world. Recent UN estimates have shown as much as 20 million tons of plastic end up in the world's oceans each year. Once in the ocean, plastic does not go away, but breaks down into microplastic particles. The report recommends a more responsible approach to managing the life cycle of plastics in order to reduce their impacts on our oceans and ecosystems.
Planned Parenthood sued Texas today over efforts by Republican governors to block Medicaid funding. Texas plans to remove Planned Parenthood from the Medicaid program by December 8th. 13,500 women statewide depend on Planned Parenthood for their health care. Cecile Richards, Planned Parenthood's president, said they won't back down or close their doors on their patients and hope to protect their health care access with this lawsuit. 10 women have joined the lawsuit against Texas. Federal courts have managed to stop similar attempts by a handful of other states like Alabama, Louisiana, and Arkansas while the lawsuits play out. In 2012, Planned Parenthood lost a lawsuit against Texas over their elimination from the Women's Health Program. The state of Texas has accused Planned Parenthood of performing abortions in a certain way to procure fetal tissue for medical research and of selling it for profit after anti-abortion activists released videos that have now been discredited. Planned Parenthood denied these accusations as it enters the legal battle.
2 years ago, a young woman in England named Martha Fernback swallowed half a gram of powdered ecstasy. She died of an overdose 2 days later. Her mother, Anne-Marie Coburn, has been working ever since to change the drug laws in the United Kingdom and internationally. She helped start a project called Anyone's Child, Families for Safer Drug Control. It's a network of families whose lives have been wrecked by the drug laws and are now campaigning to change them. KABU reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Anne-Marie Coburn to learn more about Anyone's Child.
My name is Anne-Marie Coburn. I am Martha's mum.
Please tell me about Martha.
Martha was my only child. She was a wonderful human being and taught me a lot in life. I never thought I would be sitting here in this position, that's for sure. So I'm still in shock. But I lost my girl 2 years ago to an accidental ecstasy overdose in a beautiful part of Oxford in England. So I've come over to Washington to meet other families like me, for our collective voices to be heard in order that we can push for changes to the drug laws.
I want to get to your book, 5,742 Days, in a moment. But first, I want to find out about Anyone's Child.
Well, Anyone's Child is a project which consists of families who have been adversely affected by the drug laws. In the UK for the past year, we've been meeting, we've been doing some media, we've been to Downing Street to hand in a letter to David Cameron to demand change, because our stories show how inadequate and outdated the current drug laws are. We can't have this being something that becomes normalised. You know, there are 50 deaths in the UK every week at the moment, although the government don't want you to know that. And when your 15-year-old child dies, of having had ED access to dangerous drugs, as all children do, you know, you start to ask questions, you start to look for answers. And that's what I've been doing ever since. And I've been making it very difficult for politicians in the UK to stick to the party line and to continue to support prohibition, which never worked for alcohol and it does not work for drugs.
You've been working along with the folks at Transform, my friend Steve Rolls and all the rest, preparing for the upcoming United Nations General Assembly special session on drugs, the UNGAS. Talk to me about that.
Well, we know that it's been brought forward 4 years because of the problems in South America particularly. You know, and I'm always saying to people here, if we don't sort this out, that is our future. The plan is that we're going to take families from different regions from across the world to UNGAS. We're going to be standing outside there with either pictures of our loved ones or their empty shoes, and we are going to make it very, very difficult for them. But we want to show them the human cost, because amongst policy, it can become very clinical, and they can forget what is resulting in those laws. But we are there to show them, this is the true cost. Now, we don't want our stories to become your stories. So you've got to sort something out now, you know, because, you know, it's not good enough to be us. Yeah.
That is terrific. Now, I think I'm ready to ask you about your book, about 5,742 Days.
Well, within a few hours of Martha dying, I got my laptop out and I needed to get out the agony that was in my head. I was clambering around trying to clear up the mess, having lost my only child a few hours previously. And I started to write and I couldn't stop. I wrote for 3 days without stopping for a break. And I wrote my diary of the first 102 days without her, and it finished on what would have been her 16th birthday. I'm very grateful for the book. It's now being used in schools. It's been used with parents and teenagers. It's been used by bereavement counsellors. And, it depicts a parent, a real-time account of the aftermath of losing their child. And it shows you what was going on in my mind. Yeah, there's now a play of the book, in fact, and the play is called What Martha Did Next. So that's a wonderful byproduct of my sad story. So I write to help myself. I write to keep myself company. I live by myself. I'm a single parent. And but by being able to write, I can try to make some sense of it, but I can also write for, you know, I've written for the Huffington Post and Mum's Net. And by being able to do that, I can communicate out to the world, to other families, normal families and so on, and say, please listen to my writing, please listen to what I'm saying, because I'm doing this as a safety-first approach to drug policy that I believe in. And I want to save lives. I don't want the world to lose another Martha.
Anne-Marie, I'm so very sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
I am so very grateful to you for turning that grief into something as powerful as what you're doing.
Thank you. It's been lovely to speak to you.
Oh, you're not done yet, because I have to ask, where can people find your book, and do you have a website, that kind of stuff? How can people find out more?
I have a lovely